This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, Trumpet Hour listener. This is the week interview program for Friday, March 29th. I'm Philip Nice with our Philadelphia Trumpet staff writers. We have here in studio Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
Joining us soon will be Andrew Miller. There in Edstone, England, at our studio is Mihailo Zekic.
Good afternoon.
And beside him is Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
He's the assistant managing editor of thetrumpet.com, and you can find this program and so very much more at thetrumpet.com. You can get our daily email brief. You can watch the Trumpet Daily program. So be sure to check out the fruit of Mr. Palmer's work and Mihailo Zekic, Jeremiah Jacques, and Andrew Miller's there at thetrumpet.com. Here on the Week in Review program, we're going to cover the four quadrants of the world. We're going to start with the Middle East, and Mihailo Zekic watches the Middle East all week long, all month long, all year long, and he's going to give us an update on the main stories this week out of the Middle East.
Well, last week I promised to talk about the UN vote on an Israeli ceasefire if anything interesting happened, and it did. Russia and China vetoed the U.S. ceasefire. It was Russia and China that actually stepped in and protected Israel. That wasn't why they were doing it. They claimed that it was too harsh on the Palestinians. And so you fast forward on Monday this week, and the 10 non-permanent members of the UN Security Council decide to form a resolution that's almost exactly the same, except they don't link the ceasefire with releasing hostages. That one everybody agrees with, including the United States. They didn't vote for it. They abstained it, which is just a cop-out, basically, so they don't look too bad to their Jewish voters in an election year. But in between that time, you had the U.S. talking about Russia and China are sabotaging the peace process. They want war. When in fact, like, they actually were the ones to postpone this. But they all ended up coming together anyway and got an even worse deal for Israel. Tying it in a little bit later in the week, yesterday, the World Court in The Hague, remember them? They just passed a ruling saying that Israel needs to open up more humanitarian corridors to get food and whatever to the Palestinians. A lot of people are taking this a little bit too extreme, tying it in with South Africa's genocide case, which we've talked about on this program before. That's not what this is. It's not as bad news as that. But this is an organ of the UN. Again, one after another, you're getting all this pressure from all sides on Israel. The Security Council vote in and of itself looks like it doesn't legally mandate Israel anything to do it. It's just a demand. Nobody's sending peacekeepers right now to invade Tel Aviv just yet, although at this rate, we'll have to wait and see. But the fact that Israel is just being marginalized from the international community more and more and more, it's a trend we watched a long time. I sometimes wonder when these stories pop up, okay, surely can't get worse than this. And then usually the next week, something outdoes whatever the big story was that past week. So we'll have to wait and see what happens this coming week.
This diplomatic fight that you're talking about at the United Nations, at The Hague, I mean, this is consequential. You think of Churchill when he's in the midst of World War II. He talked about how did we get here? And we got here through big conversations in large rooms. He uses that phrase, large rooms, and he's talking about how, you know, people spoke in soothe, purring ways, because that's how you are when you're a diplomat and you're, you know, dealing with international relations, and yet these have massive, massive consequences. And you can paint a nation into a corner. You can make it almost defenseless. You can give away part of Czechoslovakia in very civil, comfortable, sophisticated terms. So these conversations, these votes that are happening in these international bodies are certainly important. But you've got a different topic as your main topic, and yet it has everything to do with Israel and its political stability.
Yes, it involves the Israeli government, although by this time next week or perhaps a few months down the road, if everything works out as it looks like it might not be the Israeli government anymore. There is a political dispute going on within Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's coalition, where a few of his major coalition partners are threatening to leave the coalition out of something that doesn't directly concern the Gaza war, something that has been a big debate in Israeli society for a very long time. But because of the war, because of everything that's going on, including what we just talked about, it is taking a forefront, and it could potentially bring down the Israeli government. What I'm talking about is conscription, the draft. What some of our listeners may know is that Israel has mandatory conscription for obvious reasons. It has a small population and is surrounded by enemies. But there is one particular demographic that has an opt-out from that mandatory conscription, and that's ultra-Orthodox Jews, or what they would call in Israel the Haredim. Some people term them Hasidic Jews in other parts of the world, if they're going to a yeshiva or a Jewish religious school to study the Bible. And the big reason for that, well, first off, you go back to when Israel was founded in the 1940s, their first prime minister, David Ben-Gurion, he started that exemption when there were about 400 people that qualified for that exemption. There's now like 60,000, 70,000, something like that, in a country, again, of just a few million. Even that's 60,000 still represents a significant part of the population. Orthodox Jews as a whole represent over 12% of Israel's population right now. They're the fastest growing demographic in the country. And with an existential war, with mandatory conscription, with all these hundreds of thousands of reservists that were called, a lot of people are saying, well, it's not fair that everybody else has to get sucked into an existential war. Let these other guys who we consider freeloaders, let them pay their fair share. The Orthodox Jews, for their part, are worried that this is a part of the ploy of the government to get them away from the studies, to make them secular, to basically attack their identity, and which is why this topic, every few years, it keeps coming back, and every few years, a decision of the government is, we'll kick the can down the road. We're going to keep the status quo. We're not going to do anything. But the current law that's being used for that expired last year. The Supreme Court of Israel, which we've talked about before, about some of its biases, etc., validated that Israel can't keep doing this, that it's discrimination to have somebody be exempt from the draft. So the Israeli government said, okay, we'll draft a law into it. October 7th happened. They said, okay, we're not going to do anything until March, and then we're going to ask for another exemption just to keep things going. The Supreme Court said that exemption isn't valid, and this law is set to expire on April 1st. It's just a few days away. Regarding what happened actually this week, the government tried a last-minute maneuver to at least keep some of the Orthodox Jews happy and give them an olive branch, asking the Supreme Court for an exemption to at least give these schools funding to keep these students that qualify for the draft still in school. And the Supreme Court said, no, they're going to go into the draft. Why is this so important? Well, first off, the Orthodox Jews are not happy.
They want us, the Orthodox people here in Israel, to go to the Israeli army. They have one intention. They want us to be not religious. Therefore, we prefer to die. We don't mind going to prison. We prefer to die and not go to the Israeli army.
That was from a protester just a few days ago. And as you can see here, like, saying he'd rather die than get conscripted into the military, tussling with police, you could hear in the background. This is a significant demographic that is taking this very, very seriously. And Netanyahu, for his part, many of his major coalition partners, and have been his coalition partners for years, they are ultra-Orthodox interest parties. If their constituents, if their support base gets put into the draft, that's an immediate no-go for them. They're going to leave the coalition. They're going to try to start a new election. On the flip side, you have people like Benny Gantz, who joined the coalition as part of the National Unity Government. He's saying he's going to leave if this doesn't happen, if they don't start drafting.
I think the burden of going to the army and fighting needs to be shared by everyone who lives in Israel. The fact that there are people who choose to study all day long. And I love Torah. It's part of who I am. I grew up studying Torah, and I still do it. But it can't be an excuse not to take part of and to fight in the army. We need them. They could still study Torah after and before. And I have soldiers with me who also fought and kept Torah. So I don't see the problem.
That was another protester from a few weeks ago protesting that Israeli Orthodox Israeli Jews should be included into the draft. As you can see here, there's pretty divisive and there's pretty large support groups on both sides. And Netanyahu is a bit in a bind where whether he does one thing or does the other, he's in a pretty bad spot. And if, I mean, Benny Gantz has been egging to become prime minister for a while, we could potentially see both of these groups leave the government. And if that happens, Netanyahu would not have a majority in the Knesset. We'd almost certainly get new elections happening in Israel right at the moment when this Rafah operation, this final major operation of the Gaza war, is supposed to happen. This is not good news for Netanyahu.
And I think it ties into what have been the big crises for Israel over the last few months, years. Like, it gets back to this whole court case about changing the constitution and all of this, where there is this division in Israel between the religious and the ultra-Orthodox, between kind of the Orthodox and the ultra-Orthodox, you could say, where you do have this segment of Jews that get a lot more out of the economy than they put in. They're exempt from the draft. And there's a lot of anger within the religious Jews that Benjamin Netanyahu, they say, is kind of pandering to this community, giving them too much. This is a big part of the reason why there was concern about the attempt to change Israel's constitution, was that it would give these ultra-Orthodox parties too much power. And you know, I've been to Israel. I understand the animosity there. I had a friend who, if she was spat on by the ultra-Orthodox because she had clothes that were too revealing because they showed her elbows. Like, it can be a dramatically obnoxious community at times. But you've got this division. And I think it brings back to that massive story that we started with, this division between the United States and Israel, where you had this absolutely historic UN vote where the United States stood aside and let the United Nations come along and throw Israel under the bus. And that was a very significant change, where America had just this time last week was saying we cannot have a UN resolution that calls for a ceasefire without linking that ceasefire to the release of hostages, because that completely removes any incentive for Hamas to negotiate. Sure enough, almost the minute, certainly the same day that that UN resolution was passed, Hamas walked away from the negotiating table, walked away from any talks that would see them release hostages. The United States just threw 130 innocent people under the bus. And what both these stories have in common is division. You've got division internally within Israel. You've got division between Israel and what used to be its greatest ally. Melanie Phillips was just on fire on America's UN decision. Just to read some quotes on there, she said, "Today, the Biden administration wrote its name in the annals of infamy by openly joining the axis of evil against those defending civilization." I mean, that is what happened there. And I thought she made a really good point where she said this rupture with America that some of us have seen coming for a very long time, but the US and UK don't realize what they have now done. This isn't just about Israel. It's about them. It gets back to this point that you make, Philip, quite a lot about the social trends drive the world trends, drive the news trends. And we have let people bring basically openly evil ideologies into our countries, into our politics. They're anti-Western, they're anti what America used to stand for and Britain used to stand for. Good men have done nothing. These evil ideologies have got harder. And what that has done is it's left us with no sense of national purpose, national vision, nothing to rally behind. The process has been a bit different in Israel, but you have the same thing where you haven't had the sense of mission or purpose that you did in the early days of Israel. You have Hamas attack, and that does restore a unity of purpose for a certain amount of time, but months down the line, that is starting to fray. And so I think the news from Israel this week, both with that UN resolution and then some of the coalition politics, and it does show what a curse division is. And I think it's been interesting this week. I've been working on an article. I don't think it's one we're going to have out for a while just because it's such a fast-moving story. But you look at what curses the Bible talks about coming to these nations. And Mr. Armstrong explains in his free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, he really goes through and proves that the Jews in the Middle East, the nation of Judah, they're just one tribe of Israel, the tribe of Judah. There were 10 other tribes. They broke away or Israel split. And many of these other tribes, they're not included in Judah. They went their own way. They went into captivity. They disappeared from the world scene. And as he shows in that book, you've got all of these prophecies about specific prophecies to different ones of these tribes, to Ephraim, to Manasseh, where they would have national greatness. And if they've just vanished off the face of the earth, well, those prophecies are unfulfilled and your Bible is wrong. And so there have to be nations, great, powerful nations somewhere that have received these blessings. And so he shows that Britain, America, they're descended from these lost tribes of Israel. And you look at what God says of these lost tribes of Israel disobey, one of the big major curses is division, and that there will be division between Ephraim and Manasseh and Judah and these nations who break the band of brotherhood. They'll turn against each other. And it's that division that ultimately allows these nations to be conquered. Internal division, external division, it allows a whole host of other punishments to come upon them. And it really is a pivotal prophecy to watch for. And so I think that's why both of these different types of divisions, you know, the Bible shows us they're very dangerous.
I was writing notes as Mihailo was talking there, and so much of that is exactly what you just said. I mean, they said that October 7th is Israel's September 11th. And I remember September 11th so very vividly. I won't get into that, but I remember thinking the next day, we will forget. We're so united right now. But we're going to get back to our divisions. We're going to get back to our immorality. We're going to get back to our social problems that cause our strategic problems. And now we're so far past even what we were on September 10th. But it is amazing to me what's happening in Israel, because once put into combat, they are fighting in actual literal combat, like absolute base lions. I mean, the Jews, Bedouin Israelis, secular Israelis go straight into horrendous tactical situations, fighting people who want to die, who want their women and children to be martyrs. And they're going in there like pros, and just the actual literal tactical, technological problems they are solving, one after the other after the other. And they're even standing up against a lot of this international pressure, which I just said is consequential. But the disunity is killing them. The Supreme Court attacking the Prime Minister, the unity of purpose is not there, and it is absolutely killing them. Mihailo, in your notes, you had some points where these different types of disunity are leading.
Yes, the reason I picked an internal topic for Israel rather than some of this external stuff was because we talk a lot about this program on some of the divisions in America and the divisions in Britain. Well, our editor-in-chief had an article a while back called Britain's and Judah's Governments Fall, America Next. And that was mainly tying into when the election happened that brought in Mr. Netanyahu, when that process started, when British Prime Minister Boris Johnson resigned, and we were seeing a lot of other things. I almost sort of feel like it's a bit of deja vu standing at this point. We're having political crises in the United Kingdom, definitely having political crises in the United States with the election year. And even with the war, even with this thing happening that you would think, like you said, would be a unifying factor going on with Israel, there are still massive political divisions. And in this case, it's something that has been a political division for a very long time, and it threatens to bring down a wartime government. That is serious. The scriptures that Mr. Fleury went to in his article are in the book of Hosea, chapter 5. Specifically, he cites verse 5, "And the pride of Israel does testify to his face. Therefore shall Israel and Ephraim fall in their iniquity. Judah shall also fall with them." And the point that Mr. Fleury makes is that when you see some of these problems, including political problems that he makes specific reference to, happening in America and Britain, and you see them happening in Israel, that's not a coincidence. There's a link. He calls it a profound secret that is key to understanding what's happening in these nations today. If our listeners would like to learn more, he goes into a lot more detail in that article about what that profound secret is, which Mr. Palmer touched up on, and why it's relevant today.
That was Britain's and Judah's Governments Fall, America Next. And like so many other things, when it comes out, things that Mr. Fleury has written have come out, you're like, oh, yeah, I can see the importance of that. But then a few months later, or maybe a couple of years later, you look back at these articles and they're more relevant. And I'm the first to admit that, you know, I'm looking for certain things to happen in world events. You know, that's the bias, if you will. Like, we're looking for certain things to happen, and we're seeing them. You know, we are seeing these things happen. I'm like, is that just me? Is that just because I'm looking for it? No, that is the absolute case, that the things that the trumpet was writing about months and years ago are eventuating. Like, that's actually happening in the news that we're seeing week to week here in the Week in Review. But yeah, the unity of the nation being so weak that it can bring down a wartime government as it's trying to fight off terrorism, that's just a fatal weakness. And it comes not from a lack of troops or technology, but something else that Mr. Palmer was pointing to there. Mr. Palmer, we'll go to you next. You watch Europe, and will you give us a rundown on the main stories you've seen come out of that continent?
Major European economies are borrowing a lot of money. France, their public debt, their government borrowing jumped to 5.5% of their GDP, of the size of their economy. According to a stats agency this week, that was much bigger than forecasted and expected. Italy was the same. That news came a few weeks ago, but that was at 7% of their GDP, much bigger than forecasted. This is important because these economies are just not growing and aren't generating the tax revenue for structural reasons, for their economic model, the kind of their business is failing. They're not making money the way that they used to, and they're going to need some pretty innovative change to fix that. And so we can expect that to drive political change going forwards. Talking of money, the EU fast-tracked 1 billion euros in spending or in loans to Egypt. They did this because they've got a deal with Egypt to loan and give them a whole lot of money in exchange for Egypt looking after migrants, preventing those migrants coming on to Europe. So another example of the migrant crisis bringing Europe to be much more involved in what goes on in the Middle East. Then we had some documents released in Germany that the broadcaster ZDF said could be politically explosive. So these were documents from the Robert Koch Institute. That's Germany's Fauci, basically, the panel of experts that were recommending their health measures. It was over 1,000 pages of internal documents that shows what they were thinking during the pandemic. So while they were telling everyone to wear a mask, these documents show that they knew masks were useless. And they were writing internally that there was no evidence that they did anything. While they were telling people to lock down, they were writing internally that lockdowns sometimes have more severe consequences than COVID itself, and that increasing infant mortality would be expected. So again, they were locking people up while they knew that lockdowns were useless. So I mean, this goes back to the coverage that we had at the Trumpet at the time. The cure is killing us. This is people are using this as an excuse to bring about big government. But also, I think the point that we've made before, that the Western government's response to lockdown was so way off that it's discredited a lot of these governments and government systems. And again, just like with the financial story, you can see this leading to Germans wanting a very different style of government if they know that their kind of expert centralist rulers have lied to them and have actually hurt them.
As you were talking about that, I was thinking about the Trumpet's coverage there in those early days, the cure is killing us. And even before that, when we're realizing what a massive thing COVID is becoming, and as I always point out, not COVID mainly, but the government response to COVID was so massive. And I remember Trumpet Daily presenter Stephen Fleury, I was like, is it going to be this is part of the Four Horsemen, right? This is part of the plagues. This is part of the prophesied what? And he comes out without hesitation, says that this is a fake, this is a sham, this is the disease itself is not what's at issue here. And as you kind of mentioned there, I think in passing, the lockdowns killed, right? The lockdowns caused fatalities, literal fatalities. And so I think there's a big struggle underway right now to make sure that the actual information that leaked there out of Germany, those types of things, don't come out until people start to forget what it was like. We are all guilty of that. But with 4 or 5 minutes to the break, what's the main story that you want to hit us with from Europe?
This is more than a milestone. It is a historic moment. That's what German Defense Minister Boris Pistorius said about a particular event that took place this time last week. And in all of my Googling, I have only found one English language story on this, and that's behind a paywall. And what this is, it was a meeting of German and French defense ministers when they finally agreed on a set of measures to work together militarily. They've been working on trying to create a new main battle tank. This has been announced before. They've been working on this before. 2017 is when they began working on this. Once you start getting into the details of who's going to build this tank? And immediately the Germans are like, well, we are. And the French are like, well, we are. And then you've got to, you know, how do you divide that up? And who gets to build which bit? And which country is the turret getting built in? And which company's getting this contract? The whole thing got completely stuck. And talks had completely broken down. They moved that forward this week. They came up with the final agreement on how they're going to divide the production between the French company Nexter, Germans Krauss-Maffei-Wegmann. They set up a joint holding company called KNDS that's going to have a 50-50 division of how they're making it. They're going to get together again on 26th of April to finally sign this agreement. And this is something to replace the Leopard 2 tank of Germany, the Leclerc of France. So this is designed to be, you know, we don't hear about many weapon systems, but if you're a casual news watcher, you will have heard of the Leopard 2. Just like you probably heard of the American Abrams tank. Like, it's one of the big weapon systems in the world, and they want this to be the successor of that. Part of the way they got this deal through was agreeing on other side projects as well. yeah, okay, well, when they're haggling over who does what, well, now there's also going to be some details that they agreed on a Franco-German project to develop a new fighter jet. And in this one, France's Dassault is going to be the senior partner. And they're going to set up a new facility in Ukraine to help make replacement parts for weapons that are built there. And I think there were some drone agreements that they came up with at this meeting as well. So this is a major step forward in Europe working together on creating weapon systems of the future.
Just a brief observation here. I think it's really interesting that some have said that the tank is kind of obsolete in 21st century combat, especially with, you know, anti-tank weaponry getting so much more powerful. But with Russia's war on Ukraine, everyone has seen that despite the drones firing, you know, Hellfire missiles, despite infantrymen firing javelins, despite all the innovations and developments, the tank continues to play a central role on the battlefield. And of course, these new main battle tanks that Mr. Palmer is discussing here, they'll be cutting edge and designed to withstand as many of those kinds of attacks as possible. So whatever you may hear the armchair generals say, the tank is not obsolete or even obsolescent.
Yeah, you're seeing that in combat in Israel as well.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting discussion. And I think in terms of the substance of this deal, at the moment, what is on the table is a tank that would be operational no sooner than 2036. So it's a long-range plan at the moment. But the fact that they're able to come together and work this out, and there's the will to overcome obstacles that have been there for 7 years, we are starting to see in so many of the smaller stories that we're talking about each week fit into this broader picture of Europe not just spending more on its military, but overcoming the obstacles that mean that that spending gets diluted and going in lots of different directions. And there's a real will here to make Europe a military power. And you can see as that will accelerates, maybe that deadline of 2036 could very rapidly be brought forwards if they decide this is more important and worth making more money with now that they've got those agreements about who's going to make what and where. And this is one of the articles that we had in the April Trumpet print edition, the latest one that we have at the moment from Trumpet editor-in-chief. It's called Germany's Astonishing Military Rise. What I really like about this article is it does bring together, like, you know, these stories, we talk about them in isolation because this is a week in review show, but this brings them all together and shows what a powerful trend is underway, that you take the longer view and there is a massive military turnaround going on in Europe. And this is one that Mr. Flurry has been talking about since the early 90s. It's one that Herbert W. Armstrong has been talking about even before that. And you go through the 90s, you go into the 2000s, and Europe is cutting and cutting and cutting. And now we're very quickly moving in the opposite direction. And just in the last couple of years, it's been some dramatic turnaround within Europe. And all of that is right in line with Bible prophecy. Mr. Armstrong, this quote is in that article. He says, "What the world does not now realize, undercover, secret planning is proceeding furiously, uncovered by the news media, unknown by the public, but suddenly, unexpectedly, as Bible prophecy reveals, the whole world will be startled and shocked into wonder to learn that a new third world superpower has suddenly burst forth onto the world scene, a resurrection of the medieval Holy Roman Empire." This is what we are watching build right now in Europe. And that article, Germany's Astonishing Military Rise, it talks about why we're watching that, those news stories all gathered together, but most importantly, how this was forecast specifically in your Bible and exactly where as well the Bible says that this is leading.
That's Germany's Astonishing Military Rise. Check that at thetrumpet.com, as well as the vintage article, The Cure is Killing Us, that gets better with time, almost like a wine. The Cure is Killing Us and Germany's Astonishing Military Rise. Also check out thetrumpet.com/brief. You'll get Mr. Palmer's thoughts daily as he manages that daily email. You're listening to KPCG Trumpet Hour Week in Review. Stay with us.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Welcome back to Trumpet Hour. Thanks for staying with us here on the Week in Review edition of the program. We've hit the Middle East. We went up to Europe. Now we're going over to Asia. Jeremiah, in about 6 or 7 minutes, can you give us all the news from Asia this week that's relevant?
Sure. First, Vladimir Putin promised Wednesday that he does not plan to attack any NATO nations. He sees NATO's European nations arming, just like Mr. Palmer just mentioned, and he would prefer that they didn't. So he's promised that he will not attack NATO nations. So that may sound like some good news until we think back to 2021 and remember the several times that Putin promised the world that he would not attack Ukraine. That, of course, was a lie. And the West has so far determined not to stop Putin in Ukraine. It seems many Westerners are opting for appeasement instead. So who knows which other nation, in or out of NATO, Russia may be planning to target next. Another one here about Japan. Japan is supposed to be a pacifist nation as a result of its, you know, just stunning brutality in World War II. After the war, America occupied Japan, wrote up a new constitution for the Japanese that made it illegal for Japan to use force as a method of settling international disputes. So Japan is technically forbidden from maintaining any kind of military power that could be used for anything beyond the strictest defense of its immediate territory. And as part of those pacifist measures, Japan was also forbidden to export most weapons to other nations. But on Tuesday, the Japanese cabinet approved a plan to start selling cutting-edge fighter jets to other countries. So it's a major move away from pacifism and toward military normalization. And it's only the latest of many such moves the Japanese have made in recent years. Japan is quickly becoming really a military juggernaut. And for anyone who has studied Japan's history, not just in World War II, but in wars before that, you know that it's very sobering to see Japan beating the war drums once again. But then the big story of the week is that Russia is planning for a huge new push along a lengthy front line in Ukraine. That's the assessment of a new analysis by The Economist. And this push is unlikely to happen for probably the next month or so, since the arrival of spring means that the mud season will soon set in. That's a time of year that's so infamous. It has a special name in Ukraine, Rasputitsa. Basically, that translates to the season of bad roads. And of course, that mud season hinders all kinds of military movement. Napoleon Bonaparte had to slog through Rasputitsa during his invasion of Russia back in 1812, and that really slowed him down. The Nazis, too, in 1941, had to flounder through that terrible mud during their invasion of the USSR. So Rasputitsa is upon us now, but it won't last long. And when it's over, Russia will likely mount a large new offensive, just as it did around the same time last year. And this time around, Ukraine's ability to withstand it is considerably diminished as compared to last year. You know, the U.S., as I mentioned, has stopped helping Ukraine to stand up to Russia, and some European nations are failing to meet their contribution targets as well. So Ukrainian forces have had to begin rationing their shells and some other weaponry. Meanwhile, Russia's economy is all in on the war. So Russian soldiers in some hotspots are firing as many as 5 shells for every one on the Ukrainian side. And at the same time, Putin appears to be planning to mobilize hundreds of thousands of new troops for the war. And this mobilization plan may be easier now in light of the big ISIS terrorist attack in Moscow that happened last week. That was a week ago today, and more than 140 people were killed, another 360 or so injured. So a major attack. And the Islamic State, ISIS, has taken full credit for this savagery. And many experts have concluded that ISIS is very likely solely to blame, first of all, because ISIS had the motive. You know, Russian forces in Syria have been fighting ISIS for close to 10 years now. And then analysts have also pointed out that the tactics used in this Moscow attack are very similar to tactics that ISIS is known to have used in its 2015 attack in Paris. So the evidence shows that there's no reason to doubt the Islamic State's confession or its culpability. But despite all that, Putin is using some really tortured logic to blame Ukraine for the attack. And that could help him to convince more people of Russia to mobilize more men against Ukraine.
Well, he will do everything to harness hatred. Hatred, first of all, to Ukrainians, because Russian soldiers need to kill Ukrainians, need to torture them. So that helps him to dehumanize Ukrainians further. Second, he will need to mobilize more men to reconstitute his force because his army is taking heavy, heavy casualties.
That was Orsia Lutsevich of the Chatham House there, just pointing out the obvious motives that Putin has for trying to pin this terror attack on Ukraine. And beyond that, Putin has also been telling his people that this attack shows, just in general, that Russia needs to be more forceful standing up to its enemies. So this all shows that, yes, mud season is now at hand, but it won't last. And if current circumstances persist, what comes next could really be some of Ukraine's darkest days.
So much has happened since Vladimir Putin became the leader of Russia in 2000, I believe it was. And then just recently you have the sham election that you've updated us about. You have this terrorist attack immediately afterward, and you have this large offensive being readied for Ukraine amid promises to not attack NATO nations. And I was just thinking as you're talking there, every week there's an opportunity, if you will, for Vladimir Putin to be proved to not be the prophesied prince of Russia, as Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has named him and said that that is who he is. Every week there's an opportunity for that to prove not true, something to happen to him, him to lose an election, you know, him to be defeated. Yet that's not what we're seeing.
Yeah, that's right. There are plenty of opportunities for him to be ousted politically or even in a coup, such as we saw an attempt made for last year there. But he always survives, and that is in accordance with what Mr. Fleury has predicted. He's pointed especially to Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39, which talk about this figure, as you mentioned, called the Prince of Russia. And they show that he will actually play a central role in World War III. And as you said, Mr. Fleury has said that this prince is none other than Vladimir Putin. In his booklet on this topic, he writes, "When you study these scriptures alongside current events revealing modern Moscow's imperialist direction, you see that Putin is the Prince of Russia." End quote. So, you know, because of this, we can be sure that whatever happens, Putin's place at the helm is secure, and we should expect more and more aggression from him as the years go by.
That's the prophesied Prince of Russia by Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury at thetrumpet.com/library. You'll find that and a lot of other articles about Russia, about Germany, at thetrumpet.com/library. It's a pretty interesting thing to just go there and scroll through the dozens and dozens of titles that, as I said before, get better with age. The next region is Anglo-America. Andrew Miller has joined us here in studio. Andrew, what has been happening in our part of the world?
Yeah, Donald Trump had a great day on Monday. His net worth spiked from $2.6 billion to $6.5 billion after a major media merger between the Trump Media and Technology Group and Digital World Acquisitions Corporation. In more negative news, the First Lady Jill Biden gave a keynote address at the Human Rights Campaign comparing restricting sexually explicit books in public schools to what the Nazi Germans did with book burnings. And the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Maryland collapsed after a major container ship lost power and crashed into it. Before my main story today, I would like to actually focus in a little bit more on American defense news. That's something that every American should be concerned about, but really everyone in every nation on earth should be concerned about, because America has more or less functioned as the world's policeman for the last 70 or so years. Our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, just published a Trumpet brief this week on how the European Union is really hiking up its defense spending. I believe when you put all the European nations together now, they actually spend more than Russia or China. So they're basically the second biggest military in the world, still only spend less than a third of what America does. Biden asked for a defense increase this year. We'll see if he could get it, but it's less than inflation is. Some conservatives are really focusing on how America's not spending enough on its military. I don't know if I necessarily agree with that. I think our $800 billion should be adequate if it was well managed. But the bigger thing is they actually had the Heritage Foundation convened a panel this week. And the famous military historian Victor Davis Hanson was one of the keynote speakers about the danger that diversity, equity, and inclusion is posing to our military. Hanson's editorial, kind of summarizing what he talked about, he says, "Will DEI end America or America end DEI?" So he's basically saying it's like either America ends this program or this program will end this nation. So a pretty shocking title that's not just from an internet blog or something like that, from a pretty famous military historian. He points out in here that the U.S. military is currently short more than 40,000 soldiers. Pentagon is blaming youth gangs, drug use, tight labor market, a bunch of other reasons. But he said he thinks that the main reason is this like neo-Marxist diversity, equity, inclusion agenda that the military has adopted, which is basically sending military recruiters out to try to deliberately recruit homosexuals, transsexuals, anyone they deem a sexual minority, people from like racial minorities, blacks, almost like affirmative action for the military. It's like you're not just going out there like, who are the 40,000 most qualified soldiers in America? They're not even really considering that so much as they're like, can I hit the check mark of this many transsexuals, this many homosexuals, this many blacks, this many Hispanics? And he's even saying here that Hansen makes the point that it's actually because this program is supposed to combat what they call white supremacists. Not that you want white supremacists in the military, but it is actually discouraging like whites who are not supremacists, who are just patriotic and who might want to go into the military, that they're like, oh, well, we're focusing on the transgender recruitment policies right now. The Heritage Foundation of a forthcoming book called Unfit to Fight, How Woke Policies Are Destroying Our Military, where the author talks about, he says, DEI is extremely prevalent throughout military culture and is basically making it so that we may spend more than three times more than the European Union on our defense. But if you're spending a significant portion of that on salaries for people who are going through hormonal treatment or some other way that are there more to make a political point than they are to focus on what's the most effective way to defend the nation. The curse in Leviticus 26 talks about like your strength will be spent in vain. So you spend $850 billion on a project, but that money is not getting you nearly as much bang per buck as what it's buying in communist China or some of these other nations.
Mr. Palmer has often mentioned that in this Week in Review edition of Trumpet Hour here on KPCG Radio, it's about the trees, right? We're always trying to paint a picture for you of the whole forest while we're in here looking at things tree by tree, you know, observing and appraising the trees. But a piece like this, a respectable historian, not a political functionary so much, saying this mental sickness, this ideology, this approach that you have, that you're toying with, can end the defense of this nation. It's that bad, is a stark moment, is a very representative tree to be looking at that really does represent the forest as a whole, that we are at the point where we have hollowed out and hurt and maimed and putrefied the thing that the military defends, our society, for a long time now. Now we are directly doing it to the actual men in uniform.
Right. I mean, this is actually the conclusion from Hansen's article, which is pretty good, where he says, our future hinges on how quickly we discard DEI orthodoxy and simply make empirical decisions to stop printing money, deter enemies abroad, enforce our laws, punish criminals, secure the border, reboot the military, regain energy independence, and judge citizens on their character and talent and not on their appearance and politics, at least if it's not already too late. So yeah, pretty strong conclusion there. And it does bring to mind Isaiah 3 verses 1 through 3 about God taking away the leadership from end time Israel, taking away the men of war and the prudent and the eloquent and the cunning artificer and several other types of leaders. That's definitely, you're getting some sound military policy from Victor Davis Hanson, who's a military historian who does not work for the Pentagon. He's just in private practice. But I don't see anyone in the military talking like that. Like General Milley's talking about the danger of white supremacists and how that we need to embrace more DEI policies. I think his upcoming replacement, General Charles Brown, is even more extreme than Milley was,
right,
saying that like he actually wants to like put a cap on that, like if whites are 67% of the population, they will only be like 67% of the military. Or if white men are only like 40% of the population, like they'll only be 40% of the military, regardless of what Hansen says about like, well, just evaluate the resumes on merit and forget about what color the person is. That's like, so you're actually turning away qualified soldiers in order to make a political point instead of defending the
nation. I think this is an interesting tie-in with what I talked about in the first segment with, and what Mr. Palmer brought out about how the society destroys itself. And like we were talking, I mentioned that these trends in Israel and some of these other countries, they're connected with what's happening to America. On the surface, these two issues, like with the Orthodox law and this, they look completely different. They look like have nothing to do with each other, but they have the fundamental same cause. As you, Philip, mentioned, like when they're on the actual battlefield, our countries are really infamous for the overwhelming victories, for empirically, mathematically, physically doing a really, really good job. But mentally, morally, spiritually, emotionally, that's our Achilles heel. I think somebody told me once in World War II, when the Japanese were going after the Marines, their doctrine was, you can't defeat the Marines. The best you could do is kill so many of them that Washington tells them to pull back, and that's how you win. You get to the heads of the people back home rather than the actual force. We talked about, you know, Russia and some of these other countries pushing and becoming more aggressive and attacking the West and attacking America, as we do every week. They know that they can't defeat America one by one, head to toe at this point, or Israel or Britain or some of these other countries if they wanted to. But all they just have to do is sit and wait and watch the people within the countries tear at each other like scorpions in a jar. And the fact that they're happening, again, ostensibly on completely different reasons, but at the same time and with the same effects, shows that there is a link between these countries, and it's more than a physical link. And at the very least, the more we're ignorant about this, the worse it's going to get until eventually even worse things happen.
The other thing that I think is interesting is you look at British and American history, and honestly, our militaries are generally useless at the start of every war we fight. The people that rise to the top during peacetime are usually not good generals. They're good bureaucrats, or they're good at running the system. And we often have poor generals in place at the start of conflicts. What we're looking at takes that up dramatically further. It's a completely different scale of problem. And then also you look at the world today that we live in and just how much damage can be done very quickly. Normally, again, with both our countries, we do really like Fort Sumter, start of the Civil War. They're firing cannons at each side. And the only person that gets killed is somebody who gets killed when their own cannon blows up. That's the typical standard for both Britain and America at the start of the war. You start a war like that in this day and age and your nation is dead. You're wiped out by a nuclear, like, so it's especially dangerous as well in an age where a lot of damage can be done in a bolt from the blue.
Yeah, I think it's just astounding what we're seeing. I mean, we've got little names for it. We've got little acronyms for it, DEI. And we're used to waking up in the morning and watching the news and seeing people fight about it and see people make, you know, score points against each other about these things. These are nation destroying maladies. This is sickness. You know, this thing that, as we've often said on this show, you know, it used to be this side issue, this down ballot issue. Like, I'm going to pick my candidate or my political party based on the main things. Then kind of on the side, I might take into account maybe his morality, his views on, you know, what kind of laws we should follow, not civilly, but in our personal lives, with our marriages, with our families, with our children. Maybe I'll take that into account when I go into the and cast my vote. And we saw silliness at primary school and sullen teens. And we rolled our eyes about the college students. Oh, what they're teaching the college students these days. You know, I remember hearing phrases like that when I was a teenager from the older generations. And you just shrugged it off. Now we are at the point. It's March 29th, 2024. You have a military. You have the Joint Chiefs of Staff literally employing aggressively the importation of sexual deviants into the armed forces of the United States, the men who bleed and die for this country, and at this point women are now involved with, are now alongside, are now cowed by and forced into training to accommodate sexual deviants. And to be reminded constantly of this is much of what we're fighting for. You know, I direct a speech club for some of the young ladies here. And one of the things I mentioned to them in one of the introductions that I gave, we were talking about world events and we're talking about Israel, actually. And I told them it might seem quite divorced from your life, you know, as a young lady preparing for, you know, adulthood and eventually marriage and family. But whatever country a guy is from, you know what he's fighting for? He's fighting for political ideas oftentimes, but he's fighting for home. A lot of times on both sides, they're fighting for home. And so I was making that point for the young ladies to realize their important role. And what are American Marines, soldiers, airmen, Coast Guard, sailors, what is it that they're fighting for? Well, it's being brought right alongside them at this point. They can see this is what you're fighting for. This is the society that we have made, and this is what you are charged with fighting and dying for, and now it's right alongside you. Every week in review, we bring you some new milestone. This is the milestone this week, and alert yourself to the situation that we've now progressed to. The days of rolling our eyes about what they're teaching college students these days, those are long behind us now. And because we didn't stand up then, this is where we are. And how interesting that you do see this theme in other nations. You see that in the United States. You see it in other Western nations, but specific Western nations. And Mr. Palmer kind of brought out why that's the case, why there's this similar bond and similar maladies in the United States particularly, Britain particularly, and Israel particularly, and the other English-speaking nations. So make sure you go to thetrumpet.com and look for the United States and Britain in prophecy, as I think he mentioned this week and certainly has mentioned before. That's all the time we have this week for the Week in Review edition of Trumpet Hour here on KPCG. We do value you listening. We do value you emailing us, telling us your thoughts, making your comments. We got an interesting email this week characterizing each of the guys around this table that I'll have to share with you guys. We appreciate all manner of responses, be it lighthearted or more serious. And certainly, we appreciate those discussions when you email in about the news itself and what it means. And that's what we're focused on here in the Week in Review. Anyway, thanks for joining us. We'll be back with you next week. We appreciate Parker Campbell there behind the controls. Isaac Lorenz is here with us as well for production. We appreciate you listening, and we appreciate all of our listeners here on Trumpet Hour.